How's Tony?
Tony is last night he stood on his own two feet and ate a half bowl of food and drank quite a bit of water and was actually able to leap down off of a sofa. So it was amazing. He did stumble, but he looks like he's on the mend and that we're out of the woods, literally and metaphorically.
So what do you think? You think maybe he just didn't like eat for a few, you know, maybe he was somewhere he didn't know how to get food. He didn't know what to, no telling, of course.
And of course I thought how nice it would be able to have that communication. And then I thought, well, one of the beautiful things about living in, you know, milieus that bang up against each other, I don't know, the animal one and the human one. It's so nice to have a relationship with a being that doesn't involve language and its complexities, that it does involve language because they understand food, walk, and so then it involves, and dogs.
Oh, we'd never be able to love them so deeply if they could talk to us.
Not at all. Or maybe we'd love them more deeply, or perhaps it'd be skewed, or I don't know what would happen, but it seems that there's something about dogs, my dog, and dogs in general, that they just are in constant attendance to me. And they're very aware, like Tony is very aware of my inner state. Like there's no fooling. Like if I'm spiritually off, I think my dog senses it actually. And yet there's still reverence. And so it's like, there's just this incredible, I always think I just try to be like a dog relative to God, like very attentive and ready to obey God's every command. It just feels that way. And that somehow they're hip to something that if I'm off or if I'm on, they can feel that and would beyond words. So I don't know. But it would be nice to know, like, where did you go, man? Did you go into the woods? Yeah. Did you go visit a friend? I think that food, why were you so close to me on that last day? And I was so close to you. And why were you following me around while I was working? Were you getting ill? What did he go off to die? I mean, he barely made it onto the porch, you know, on Saturday night. Uh-huh. So after 3 days. And yeah, he was just dehydrated. His skin's coming back like when you pull the fur off the bones.
Does he ever scavenge from the forest? Does he eat, you know, No.
When I pull the skin up off of him when he was really dehydrated, it would just stay standing and take a long time for it to fall back onto his bones. Crazy.
Is that, I don't know. I've read somewhere, heard somewhere or something. Dogs are like one of the only animals that have and trigger within us an oxytocin response, right? The release of the hormone oxytocin, which a mother and child receive during nursing and in childbirth, that like, you know, is like the whatever, our internal love drug, so to speak. And
incredible.
Dogs, not cats, which is, you know, not the least surprising part of this story. And I like cats, but they're, you know, they're fucking lizards.
They're very different creatures. Although I wouldn't be surprised if there are aberrations in the human community where there is someone who has that oxytocin, you said, released when in the presence of a cat. I wouldn't say.
Oh yeah,
of course. But the generally it and you see people with their dogs.
Cats don't is the thing. Dogs do. Dogs also have oxytocin.
And cats oxytocin. Oxytocin.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, indeed. So then you wonder about that. See, that's curious. So, like this physical, a representation of a spiritual reality. You know, could it be spoken of that way? Are we wanting to say, oh, where there is oxytocin, there is this love drug that then affects this love state? Or is it where there's this love state, this underlying thing that often lays dormant comes into being or comes into is activated? Or like, I don't know, there's just so many ways to talk about that.
Well, what I think is a bummer is that we have a tendency to like, to say that if we could describe it that way, that would somehow ruin it. Like we would say, oh, is it reducible to that? Like it's already very telling that we would call it reducible.
That's right. And why have you done an either or, Kevin? Why not a both and, or a like, oh my gosh, upward spiral, flesh, spirit.
Different ways of describing the same thing. And this is yes. like, to my mind, this is the system of Hatha Yoga, right? Hatha Yoga. there are spiritual states that occur in a person, and there's an underlying physiological reality that we could seek to describe in ancient medical terminology, right? That's channels doing this. The wind is here in this channel doing this thing at this time. And you could, when you're there. If your winds are in this place, if your physiological state is in this place, then your mind is in this place. And if your mind is in this place, then the physiological state is in this place. It's Hatha Yoga for the sake of Raja Yoga. The point is to achieve this inner, this regal, this royal, the grand mm-hmm. inner state. And that's mm-hmm. the point of this, physical, machination, right, so to speak, that you're going to do this, right? The machine of the work, the machine of the body.
The mysterious connection between flesh and spirit, between prana and thought, between the invisible and the somewhat measurable, because it has weight. Or does it have weight?
Does it ruin the thing if it does? Does that ruin it all?
Well, no, it kind of gives us hope, doesn't it, that the very apparatus we're given is conducive to beatitude and bliss and to these ultimate states. Although I would say in stating it, we'd almost have to say it ultimate stating, because of course it's so dynamic, I think, as we on the path of love, that there's not a state. It's stating. It's like it feels as if it's important to talk about realizations as a kind of realizing. It's not something that can be, of course, it can be talked about in the past tense if one goes into a state or out of a state, but
or present, God willing.
Present. Although if one is talking about it, probably some of these deeper things might not be going on, but maybe.
I don't know. And I have this attraction to the demystification of the mystical. That we, by mystifying certain states, we set them outside of our purview or outside of the realm of what is reasonable to aspire to or to achieve, or set them in the hearts of someone who has some magic or possesses some apparatus, right? Some faculties that I don't possess. And wouldn't it be a hoot if it ain't gotta be like that? And these are states that are achievable for you or achievable for me, that are fairly like pragmatic in a sense. If this happens and this happens and this happens and this happens, then you'll be there. And I have a hard time imagining that there are states that exist that you couldn't say that about. Now, what it takes to achieve condition A, B, C, and D, right? It's a bunch of underlying conditions, and I accept all that. And there may be states, right? Like, for example, if you want to say the underlying ever-present grace of God that can be assumed, like we can't even be having this conversation if that isn't assumed already in place. And then what is built upon? Are things not built upon that? Is that not a foundation upon which things are built also necessarily? And
and I think the church fathers and mothers would say as much, at least within the Christian context. And I think also obviously the Buddhist teachers would, but I would say that the deeper the state of union in God, the deeper the state of love, the deeper the center of our being, the more hot our love becomes, the more it's the flame of love within us is similar to the flame by which we're brought and held in being. I would say that becomes more and more difficult to describe. So I think it's, while it's important to demystify, I think it's also important to hold up the mystery, because it is truly mysterious, in the sense that when I have had whatever little things that have happened to me, glimpses, it's felt very difficult to put into words, and very much a gift, and very much possibly felt as related to, oh, I made myself accident prone to this grace by doing X, Y, and Z. So while I would say the process by which we become prone to the mystery of love is something we can talk about, the realization, the realizing, the dynamic state of being that entails is almost, I would say, impossible to put into words. Even on the lower levels, much less whatever higher levels are possible, higher levels of love and union with reality, communion with reality in your deepest center, which is God and not God, or is both, or
I don't know what the word is, like magicifying the mystical or something. Like,
nice. Yeah, I see what you mean.
Not being perfectly clear about what we mean about mystical, right? If mystical means inspiring a sense of mystery and awe, the universe, if nothing else, has complexity. If nothing else, okay, I don't understand the causes by which the situation that I'm in, the blanket that I'm sitting upon, came to me. The complexity of those causes are vast and great. Any place I look, any place my eye comes to rest, there is layer upon layer of, you could say, mystery, right? That one would be justified in a sense of awe at the complexity of what brought about any subfacet of a subfacet of whatever you're looking at. To imagine it as, I don't know, causeless or random or I don't know, like to imagine it as impossible or something. I guess that I think that there's a sense that when we say like this state is, this state is so impossibly complex or something, or what you're in the presence of, it's just like impossibly complex or something, which feels right in a way. Like the sound of that word in that context, like, rings true to me in a sense, but it isn't impossible.
As does the other ring true, not to hopefully,
which is
the state of loving divine union with reality, with truth, is so simple and so utterly supernatural, natural, a complete, so close to you. It's actually within many mystical traditions, indescribably simple, actually. But you're describing what appears to the senses. And so wherever eye, ear, or touch can come into contact with, there are infinite complexities that hopefully would cause some sort of worshipful state or some sort of state of devotion. Mm-hmm. Yet the state that the mystical experience does not involve the senses. Mm. You're in the realm of the invisible. You're precisely dealing with something that cannot be touched, cannot be seen, cannot be this union at the deepest recesses of our being. This union with truth, it's not privy to the senses. But
yeah, I don't know if I accept that. There's a question about what we. It's partially just what we're calling a sense, and that
oh, if you want to include, if you want to broaden the notion of the senses, then.
Well,
then
and the reason I think it's important for me,
yeah,
right, to broaden the notion of the senses in this sense is because I have some skepticism that the basic five, you know, normal empirical senses that we talk about, I have some skepticism as to the how well those function without a broader idea of what a sense, without the sense of the mind, without the sense of inner conception, without the sense of understanding. This other sense, right, this sixth sense that we might talk about, right, the mind's capacity to think, to conceive, to interact with itself, that not only do I want to include that as a sense, but I want to say that I don't know that the other senses work without it anyway.
Oh, they certainly work with it being terribly maimed and the mirror of the inner eye being very dirty and unpolished and full of obstacles. But there is a sense in which once that inner mirror of the heart is cleansed, I would say that the senses finally take on their true life and that there's a deep connection. However, when one is in deepest union, or as as union with love inside, you know, as we deepen in our life of stillness, quietude, contemplation, meditation, which we carry into the world and into our work, hopefully. But it does seem that the senses play less and less a role and maybe even shut down sometimes. However, I would say that when one comes out of that potentially, that the senses almost like water never tasted so good or touching your wife's hands never felt so profoundly intimate. And you didn't even know what the life of the senses was until the inner eye, at least one little speck off that heart was started to get like polished a little bit, like something, some obstacle, some veil, some cloud was removed. I don't know though. I've had such limited experience, but the experience I've had, everything I've said jives with what I just said. Everything I've experienced, the limited things I've experienced jive with what I just said.
But I should say and. Yeah. Right. Even a sense of what may or may not be quote reducible or parallel or describable to oxytocin moving through the blood. The sense that we love, like the welling of love and devotion for even just, you know, an individual in our family or in our life that we care for. This sense feels to me like an experience of inner eye, right? And having had experiences, you know, at moments in my life that seemed more or less mystical, when I just think about how much I love somebody, I feel like it counts. I feel like it's a little bit, right? And I'm swept up in the day, but it's like on that level, even a whisper of it at least, right?
Oh, and, gosh. And not only that, it's hearkening deeper and deeper experiences of union with reality. I mean, those are the experiences that almost, they gird up they're the foundation throughout the day.
We have all these words that in spiritual vernacular, it's very hard to talk about what I'm trying to say without it sounding profane, right? Like I want to say like, this mundane sense, right? We've already pigeonholed it by calling it mundane, whatever. Mundos, you know, menudo, whatever, having to do with the world, right? Like, but does it have to be, but now that word has taken on a profane connotation in the spiritual, you know, vernacular, in the spiritual discussions that I feel like we're typically exposed to. Yeah. But if that sense is not to say mundane in the sense that it's normal, but mundane in the sense that you are always standing at the window of the divine. Mundane in the sense that there is never a moment where you are not standing at that window. That's appealing to me.
Right, right. And then mundane, which is not so much a problem, I think, I like that mundo, el mundo, the world, and the idea that there is not so much anything that is mundane. However, there is the clouded intellect and the overused senses and dulled senses that then casts upon the created beautiful world a kind of a torpor or a veil. And so it's not so much, the problem isn't so much in the sense, it's the problem is what has happened to the sense in the fallen world. It's what has happened to the sense in the world of samsara. The sense has been dulled. So, you know, we're encouraged to carefully fast, to get lighter, to carefully, to almost, to actually not live in the realm of the senses so much, not as a negation of the senses, but as a healing of the senses so that they can actually function to bring us to ultimate happiness. Because the way they are right now, generally, the senses are both portals and they present incredible problems to the life of the spirit and the heart.
Well, and I think so, it wouldn't be hard for us to establish that as being true of the of inner sense, right? That there is, you know, profanity of the inner sense, abuse of the inner sense, right? Dwelling upon...
Could speak of that as mundane, yeah.
Yeah, right.
For goodness sake.
Sure.
Let's do that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, whatever. Sitting and watching TV, which, you know, look, I like to do and I keep, you know...
Yeah, me too.
I try to do only a civilized amount of it and I don't know how much that is. When I did long retreat with my inner eye, I could watch TV shows that I had seen many years before.
Oh boy.
And that's cool. and when you don't have a TV and you don't have,
believe
you know,
me,
you're not,
so you use the
it's delightful. No, it's amazing. Yeah. Remembering an episode of a TV show, probably The Simpsons, is as entertaining as watching that episode of TV when you haven't seen a TV in a year, or, you know, watched a show on a computer screen, or checked your email, or or you know, maybe read a novel, or you've read one novel in the last year or something. like watching The Simpsons in your mind. An incredible distraction, right? But then, like, also, right, like a dulling of the inner sense,
yes,
as opposed to honing it for science.
Cool.
Maybe it isn't, right?
I like where you've I like where you've carried this, actually, because it's like, well, then in what does dull the inner senses? Sure, we're going to say messing with the outer senses and overstimulating them or understimulating. This can deeply affect the inner eye or sense,
Subtler, right? Just like the inner sense,
that's right,
seems to be this organ with which we interact with love. It's also an organ through which we interact with, wanton or wasteful lust and hatred, resentment with that same inner organ. That may be clean or not.
That
clean.
Indeed was where I was going. Yeah, I was just laying out the first part. But yes, that's right there.
Right. So I'm really, of course, I'm trying to establish this inner organ as
another
an organ just like any other, which we are taught to think means that I'm debasing it. And I don't see that it should be such when we say an organ just like any other, right? That means that our other, just like we can interact with the divine through the inner eye, then that if that were true, then it would mean that we could interact with the divine through our outer eye as well. And that would be very good.
Right. With some caveats, like with some explanation there, like I want to push back a little there. Just that, we there's a, I do feel that there's a for the senses to take up their proportionate role within the spiritual journey into God or to truth or to happiness, however we wish to state it. Not that all those are necessarily the same, but whatever journey we're on, that these senses do have to take a back seat for a while, and they need to not be pampered for a while, and they need to be purified for a while, and it hurts. If we do start taking away supports that we just think are reasonable, that perhaps as our spiritual life deepens, the amount of TV shifts or none at all, like you've done mm-hmm. at times, or our relationship to food, everything kind of shifts. But always, I think, for me, the watchword is gentle, because, you know, to me, my goal is life in God, which and God is in essence merciful and loving and self-emptying and gentle. There's such a, in any time I've ever felt the presence of God in a way that was seeming to do something sustainably transforming in my heart, the gentleness with of the approach from reality. It's very, why am I bringing this up? I guess just to say, there's just a stringency required relative to the yeah. senses to be able to cleanse the inner eye, but I have to engage in it without self-disgust or self-hate. Like, it's very,
I want to say I think so, but I don't know if that's true. But those are also the only methodologies that I happen to know. It's also true in my experience, what you're saying. I'm hesitant to demand that the only way is to starve the outer senses. For better or worse, that's also the methodology that I'm familiar with and has been useful to me. Yeah, but...
Or that we're familiar with, right? The same, being taught from similar schools for long periods of time.
Yeah, and right. But you go to the Grand Canyon, you see, you know, a sunset on the ocean, and yeah. there are things that one can do with the outer senses.
Right.
Right? That can be cleansing to the one's connection with inner senses.
I will say that a saint who has gained control of her senses completely, whereby there is never even a tendency of overeating or overstimulation or too much. There's not even a boy, does she see that sunset.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Sure.
Yeah. So that's kind of what I'm saying. It's not so much.
I know that.
Yeah.
I know
okay,
that. And
okay.
And I agree.
I know. I just want to keep going there because
I'm entertaining the possibility. Okay.
Yeah.
That there may be some methodology that I was not trained in, or that you were not trained in, whereby rather than starving the five senses, to gain closer entrance, to gain, to sort of turn down the volume on the five senses so that we can finally hear the inner sense a little better, that there could be some way of choosing what the five senses engage in some different way that would have a similar effect. I'm open to that. I don't want to say that they must be turned down to, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. That is also the way that I'm trained. That's also what I'm familiar with.
As far as I can see, consistent through all traditions. And I would be careful for myself right now with the word starve. And I liked where you went after that. And when you talked about, you didn't say dialing down, but you just said the phrase. Anyway, you mm-hmm. said something like, so for me, it's a proportional response. It's such a gentle, it's such a kindness to eat half of the amount that I used to. It's been mm-hmm. It's not been a starvation. It's been a running to, like, it's such mm-hmm. a basic mm-hmm. thing for me, is the tongue and the control of it. And just dealing with that one sense and not being, you know, not being overwhelmed by the other, like, you know, what am I going to take? Oh, let's take on the tongue for a few months, like in terms of lying or not lying or speaking truthfully or eating, like just all the things that happen around the tongue. And it seems almost like the tongue became this a doorway into all my problems. Like I was literally like, oh my gosh, if I could not starve the tongue, but just let her be, let it be in its proper portion to the reality I'm trying to aim my life towards, this whole, so that I'm proportioned to the summit of being, our whole life is a crescendo in a way to something, we're moving somewhere. And then this tongue is not operating in accord with where I want to go. It just isn't. So,
well, and of course the story of the Buddha, right, is tied up in this journey of what some people call the middle way, right, which is not the philosophical middle way, but this idea that neither, you know, full indulgence nor fasting,
right,
suited the prince's needs to have a spiritual, which is cool, right? Because also he's talking about this very physical vehicle and what
time, right,
shape this very physical vehicle very cool had to be in, mm-hmm, in order to achieve, mm-hmm, these in, you know, non-physical, super physical, you know, whatever, yeah, internal,
yeah,
goals. But also the story of the fasting sure seems essential to that, you know, that this is one who went through fasting, partook of fasting so very deeply to come to this experience. Well,
and then in the rule of Saint Benedict, you know, we get, from which all the monastic rules in Christianity come, Saint Benedict, who is, you know, by tradition seen to be divinely guided, forbids what he would call such nonsense as that 6-year, 5-year fast of the Buddha. That's not taking care of your holy temple properly. So, mm-hmm, and I think Lord Buddha would for sure, in the vows that came out of his enlightenment, were certainly reflected that. I mean, as deep as any religion I've ever seen, right, actually. Right. I mean, yeah, to almost,
well,
to
maybe
a,
he fasted for our sins that none of us,
you
should
know,
have
maybe
to fast.
He did. Yeah, and maybe really like did it as an expression of like, don't do this. Now, then I would say that there's just something about following the, in the rule of Saint Benedict, there are prescribed fasts, and he would often chastise the young monks who tended towards spiritual athleticism. Oh, I hear you like fasted and then you've continued your fast. And then some of the brothers knew, you stop fasting when I tell you to stop fasting. You don't get to decide when you get to fast and when you, and this is what is so lacking in my life right now. And I think in the modern world, which is, it's not so much, is this going to be good for your chemistry and your brain or your body? It's your abbot told you to fast on Thursday and Friday, and now you've brought it into Saturday and you've let other monks know. It's an absolute disaster of a fast. And by the way, you don't ever do that again, or I'll ask you to leave the monastery. You do as,
well,
I tell you.
Especially so, this is profound in a modern setting, as you say. We
that sounds
have
terrible,
a,
right?
Well, we have no. We have such a crisis of trust. To trust the abbot, to trust someone outside of us to tell us what to do, is essential and feels untenable in this, you know, modern era as I experience it, which is in such a crisis of trust. A crisis of who we can trust about anything. And of course the very modern, and that's not, you know, modern doesn't mean, you know, this week or something. You can see it over, you know, you know, the vast, maybe that long, you know, vast modern literature. I mean, when I think of like reading my first introduction to Buddhism on some level, or one of my first deeper introductions to Buddhism was Hermann Hesse, who seems, when he tells this story of Siddhartha, that this being, that this individual meets a Buddha, rejects a Buddha, knows that he has to do it for himself. And I was so inspired by this as a kid, you know, and now I just think like, oh, yuck, you know, this is this, you know, Western individualistic, I have to do it my way. It needs to be achieved on my terms, you know, individually. Yeah. No one can tell me what to do. In the end, no one can tell me what to do like I can. And
right. And I think a person on the path of love, on what the stuff would kind of senses, has probably a little more self-distrust. Where and I just want to say something about obedience, because it's not that the young monk didn't realize that he had more in him and that it might have been appropriate and actually good for his body to have one more day off. You see, the whole thing, it's not even whether the advices of the abbot are wrong or right. Of course, there's a better way to shovel the pig pen, but you weren't asked to shovel it that way. And the obedience of the brotherhood and the sisterhood, and that's actually what's going to open your heart. It's going to open your inner eye. Trust that. And now, the reason I bring that up is because I do believe the modern life, which is generally a married life, is a rich life of relationship. Or if we're younger and we don't have a loving relationship or a partner that we're with, you know, friends, that it affords so many moments of obedience. There are so many moments where we can put our own wishes aside.
Certainly.
And do the wishes of others. And this, and trust that polishes the mirror of the heart. Trust that process. And I don't believe we trust it. I think I have a sense that freedom means being able to do what I want.
It's a large-scale crisis.
It's huge. It's more than just the gurus who are being inappropriate.
Especially in our, you know, our fucking poor, precious, particular fucking country, you know, excuse me.
Poor, precious.
It is a crisis, the capacity to which we flee in terror from trust. Which is not to say that our trust hasn't been abused.
Yeah, no kidding. That there isn't reason.
It has been. That's not, you know, I understand. You know, I'm sympathetic to it. There's danger in the trust. And there's danger in having no trust. And neither position is tenable. And you see groups of people trying very hard to do one of these two untenable positions, which is to trust wholly or trust none at all.
And I, for better or for worse, tried to walk a line with my teacher, with our teacher, and I don't know if I could ever get it right. You know, I do think there's something about a group of people rather than having maybe direct advices, but where brothers and sisters or some kind of lay community that could be developed whereby we follow how does this play out? Because I just don't see this inner eye fully opening without obedience. And so obedience to what, in what way? And then it really calls into question, what is the nature of freedom? And I would beg myself and others to, have you had a time in your life when you've just been able to do whatever it is you want? And just like, oh, I'm so happy. I question that happiness. I really do. I don't think that happiness is contingent upon being able to do what one wants or having the illusion that one is able to do whatever one wants. Because of course, when it's our time to go, it's our time to go. But we're not in as much control, but that the illusion of control and the illusion that control is the bringer of happiness, well, maybe it's part of it. Maybe there's an admixture. But I think we should engage in a little more mistrust as to the nature of what we think freedom is. I mean, down to COVID masks, right? We've seen the nature of freedom is on trial right now in this country.
Right.
So then that ties in so deeply with what we're talking about, obedience and inner eye. And
it's a fascinating example to see people, you know, who are using you know, for whom that the mask, and, you know, not to date this conversation, you know, but people will remember throughout our lifetime, that a time when a mask was a symbol for some of freedom and a symbol for others of bondage at the same time.
So one for freedom. For one, a symbol of love. And
I can go out and I can, well, it's freedom because I can do things with a mask on. I can do things,
Say. Not freedom, put it on out of love for others. Okay.
You don't even have to say that.
That's great.
Yeah, it's beautiful, but you don't
practical.
Even have to go that
don't
far.
Have to go there. Just simple, like, I can go do stuff without having to worry.
I can go do stuff again. And I'll, it's not that I don't have to worry, but I'm taking measures to gain more freedom so that I don't die or kill people. When I go outside, when I go interact with others,
it seems something so simple, and the kinds of things that this has brought up, the depth of conversation. I mean, I was speaking with my mother-in-law, who is an Anglican in England and was not a follower of Christ or in Christian religion when she was bringing me up in my teenage years in London, and. And she just, what is all this nonsense about the mask? Everyone's just, I mean, if you're overweight and you're not taking care of yourself, of course you're more susceptible to the underlying factors such as illness and death. And I mean, I think this is really God's way of, I mean, quite frankly, it's a little bit of a slap on the bottom, you know, this COVID thing. And I'm like listening to this going, like, are you suggesting, there was almost like a suggestion of a weeding out of and you know what I mean, take care of yourself and don't wear a mask and let's live with this thing. And I was just, I literally, that was the woman who raised me. It just is so contrary to what my understanding is. Uh-huh. Although I did try to meet her position. But it did shock me a little. It smacked of imperialism or some kind of pride or some kind of, like, because I'm, you know, not a glutton, I'm not going to die of COVID. Like, what? Right. What does that have to do with Jesus? I thought you said you were a disciple of Jesus. I don't know. Would Jesus wear a mask?
The idea that you wouldn't protect yourself from any number of dangers, you know, it's like, why should I sleep in a house, COVID or cobras, you know, they all work the same way, you know, what would I do to protect myself from a cobra bite?
Well, then what do you say to this? What do you say to this then? Well, of course, I mean, and then you look at the numbers, the sheer statistics. This is absolutely no worry really there, you know? I mean, you have a better chance of dying falling down the stairs, man. You know,
and this is the thing, is the conversation over and over and over. And I don't want this to be this conversation, you know, but of course, you know, how we don't even notice when the conversation turned from, is the mask protecting me to, is my mask protecting other people? And I have been to restaurants and I have worn a mask when I go in my thing. Then I go and I sit at the table and I eat food and I don't know if I've had COVID or not had COVID. You know, I don't, you know, I've never tested positive. I've had, you know, vaccinations. I don't know. For all I know, I've had it. There were times, you know, and you can transmit it without, you know, manifesting it.
And have massive viral loads and like, oh my gosh, I can totally hurt
someone. The question is, have I killed people over the course of this thing? And it's just, you know, statistically, yeah, maybe.
Well, right? Oh
yeah, maybe.
Gosh.
Yeah, maybe, Ben. You might have killed people. Yeah. You know, just walking around, doing your, you know, sometimes you wore a mask, sometimes you didn't. Sometimes the state wanted you to wear a mask, sometimes it didn't. And so sometimes you didn't, sometimes you didn't. And then it ramped up and they said, now you need a mask again because it's getting bad. Did I kill anybody over this time? Right.
And I did say at some point, too, and I'm glad that this came up, frankly. I did say it's at one point to Yvonne, like, I'm not talking about your safety right now when I'm just suggesting that you wear a mask. I'm actually not. And you made an interesting thing. At some point, the conversation shifted from protecting yourself. And this happens in these conversations where all of a sudden the object shifts and it shifts imperceptibly. That's interesting.
Right.
And that's interesting relative to spirituality and the development of the soul, because the vigilance of recognizing when we are no longer using the tools that have been given us and the food that has been graced to us through seeds working in rain, that we're no longer doing it in God or in something, we're not giving glory to something very deep and profound, and we're just simply using, we're simply relating to the world functionally. I do think that somehow the world functions better when we don't relate to it purely functionally.
And when the inner eye is occluded such that it sees only self-service as self-service and doesn't understand that service of all is service of
all
self-service. And service of self.
Yeah, and service of self. Nice. Yeah, yeah. The Dalai Lama's famous enlightened self-interest, which is just
such a beautiful cataract upon the inner eye that occludes all but the service to ourselves as service to ourselves, all but the obvious service to ourselves as being service to ourselves. And a healthy inner eye just doesn't make such a mistake, understands that we are all inexorably linked, understands the obvious nature. It's not, you don't,
it's and again, not even that
you
subtle.
Don't have to get Thank mystical. You. It's not even that
no.
subtle. It's not that hard to understand that not caring for the health of everyone around you is what makes you sick. It's not that confusing.
It's not hard to understand that if you've exported some form of fascism or dictatorship as the American Empire has to about 80 countries, which we could list, which we won't, that fascism would come to roost in our country. I mean, these kinds of things.
It's hard to understand that if we were worried about creating petri dishes in different parts of this small world for new variants to spring up of this disease, that if we were devoted, if our, you know, if our economy that we seem suddenly so capable of turning off, turning on, doing what we want, pouring magical money into it, taking magical money out of it, if we mechanized the way that we did to shut down everything on a dime, if we mechanized and we said we're ramping up, we're turning on the economy again to create global vaccination, right? That that we wouldn't be getting new exciting strains from places that we don't give a fuck about.
Yep.
And then, you know, whatever number of Americans wouldn't be sick today.
Because
we prevented illness and...
But of course you must do the numbers, man. I mean, this is the thing.
It is what I'm saying.
Look at all the people who die of vehicle accidents or from heart attack. It's just another thing that kills people. Get over it, Ben. What are you talking about? This is just unrealistic. Can we just get back? You know, this is like what I'm hearing from so many people who I love, and it hurts. Yeah. Like I try to see their point of view, but if there's a 1 in 10,000 chance that my kid could die of going to, like, well, then I would do, like, I don't know what to say. It's just another thing that can kill us and another thing that we should take precaution over. And it's more importantly, what you're saying, another thing that can kill somebody else and you don't even know it.
There's a reason the life expectancy of a human is no longer, you know, 40 or whatever the hell. I mean, we're working on it. And
we are willing
over time to refine our capacity to care for the human body. And it seems to be effective.
Admittedly, that capacity is not unlimited in the way we're acting. And one can begin to make very difficult arguments about life support machines, about the way we approach death, mass killing fishes in the sea. We can make arguments that say, hey, you know what? Better that we don't ramp up production and do all these things. And you know, so that also has to bring But at least it needs to be, I mean, I think probably it is a conversation, I mean, but that needs to be a
and
conversation.
Ramp up production of what? I mean, that's
of
the
what?
Thing. Ramp
exactly.
up production of what? I mean, uh-huh. there was this, the fact that the world stopped for a moment. Like, I mean, I can't, you a week before, every, just about every nation on earth shut down. You would not have convinced me that this globe was capable of that.
No way. And whales could communicate in new ways, and children saw.
I would not have believed it. I would not have believed it. If you told me even just the United States of America would say to everyone in this country, stay home, that we would have the capacity to mostly, right, shut down, you know, all non-essential businesses in this country, much less the world, to mobilize on that scale.
It's, and then to witness it its effects. That's a both
it
were just
belies the delusion of what we think we can and can't do. That if we wanted to feed every mouth on this earth, if we wanted to vaccinate every arm on this earth, if we wanted, we just could. We just totally could. We just definitely could. It just no doubt. We just certainly could. Yeah, just no doubt about it. No doubt it. This nation alone could do it if that's what we just decided. That's all. We would only have to decide, and we would reap benefits.
Yeah.
And that isn't that mundane. You see, look how many times I used the word, you know, mundo in English, right? How many times I used the word, the world word, the word world, you know? But see, it's, right. And now I'm going to use, I wanted to use the word holistic, right? It's not, it's holistic mundane thinking or something, but now I've used like a hippie word that,
which is loaded. That,
yeah, it's loaded. Well, and now, right, it seems like we're leaning again into the realm of the mystical by using a word like holistic to talk about what it means to stand back far enough to view this pale blue dot, right, from space, as if with the eye that we, you know, that a child imagined God looks upon this world and how different this world looks from a distance. And it's not impractical. It's not fantastical. It's not, there is such a perspective that is possible to view this world from. It is possible to view this world from a distance. I just saw a picture taken of
Saturn.
No, it was, and what was his name? Cooper or something. The guy in the, who flew the craft that orbited the moon while the lander landed on the moon. And he took this picture of the craft and the earth.
Yeah.
And the caption to the picture said, everyone who has ever lived or died is in this picture, but the photographer. You see, because the earth was in the picture and the landing craft was in the picture and he was taking the picture, you know, everyone who ever lived or died was before him. We can imagine it is possible to zoom out. It is. And sometimes it seems almost just that easy. Yes. What about the numbers? Well, which set of numbers? How are you occluding your perspective of the numbers? Which numbers are you leaving out to look at the numbers? There are so many numbers. There are so many numbers. There are so many of us. There is so much going on in every moment. And when you, sometimes it's just stepping back a moment, right? And looking at the Grand Canyon, right? I said, looking at the sunrise or the sunset on the beach. What is it about those things on some level, you know, what is it about looking at the sky that suddenly with the outer eye seems to have an effect on the inner eye on some level? I suspect because it's big. It's just so big. It's just so much.
And it certainly implies the vastness of our souls, so that you wouldn't possibly you'd feel like the body is contained by the soul in a certain sense, or by our invisible being, that which is like that vastness sort of does imply our own vastness, or else how could we perceive the vastness in a way?
That's and interesting.
So I guess the perception of God implies a way in a likeness, something, an analogy. If I'm crying out to God, isn't God crying out to me in the very depths of my own being, from the summit of my own being, from the, how could it? I mean, there's a sense in which if you're looking out at the sunset, isn't it looking it back at you? I mean, what is happening there, and why does it seem to?
And as I say, the inner sense that I want to count just right along with the five, the way that the five lean upon the inner sense to process, to accept what
great
is
meaning
before them,
yeah,
that the inner eye must swell to accept, to process what's before it when it sees majesty.
Yeah, not necessarily just the other way around. That's lovely. Yeah, I mean, what is it for the Mexican child during COVID in Mexico City to see stars for the first time in her life, in his life? Like, what? There's enough plane traffic not happening, and enough dialing down, and enough that people are seeing stars who haven't seen stars. Oh, I mean, if that is a metaphor for COVID all around, like when you said that the whole world could have done this together as an accord, it does speak to some parousia. It's a French, like parousia is like the bringing of all that is, like including the guy who's taking the picture into this unified reality, where each individual is respected.
I wonder if it's related to Purusha. I wonder if it's related to the word, you know,
Purusha, man. Oh, goodness. Soul in Sanskrit. Yeah. Or man. Well, that's a, I'll look into it. It's Parousia.
Well, maybe not. But, you know, maybe not.
Yeah, maybe not.
Maybe not at all. Not at all is also possible. Well, cool, dude. Thank you, man. I love you, bro.
I love you, too.
I'm glad you're well. I'm glad your family is well. I'm glad your dog is well today. And, you know, I'm glad that we're spending this time together, and we only have a short time together, all of us, in this way, at this time, in this space. We see people come and go, and I'm glad that I'm glad that I remember it sometimes while I'm in the midst of it, that I get to spend a morning with you, with a friend whom I love, thinking of, you know, of how to love and how to be, how to expand my heart to hold more, which certainly feels like who I want to be. And there are mechanics that underlie that and that we can talk about, but I feel confident that I want to expand my heart to hold more.
Mm. And hopefully we can keep bringing out the subtleties of the mechanics and help each other live it. That's sort of the...
Yeah, should time allow. That's no, no, no COVID, no cobras this week. And we get to keep talking as long as we steer clear of cobras and COVIDs. I love you, dude. I'll talk to you soon.